We're taking a look at space on the program today and talking astronomy and what we can see in the night sky. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Jim Lattice is one of our guests. He's director of the UW-Madison Space Place, a faculty associate in astronomy at UW-Madison. Jim, welcome back. And with us as well is Dean Regas. Dean is an astronomer for the Cincinnati Observatory in Cincinnati, Ohio, a renowned educator, author, national popularizer of astronomy, and an expert in observational astronomy. And Dean, it's great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So as we talk with Dean and Jim, I hope you'll join in. Interested in learning more about the night sky? What would you like to know about space and galaxies? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Dean, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about the Cincinnati Observatory.
Oh, this is one of the most unique institutions in the country. It's got the two very historic telescopes, including one telescope that's the oldest in the country, 178 years old. And we're a public institution, so people come over and look through the telescopes and see all sorts of stuff during the daytime, during the nighttime, and really get these kind of a glimpse of what it was like to do astronomy back in the 19th century. And it's just, incredible programming we do there for school kids, scout kids, big kids like me, adults, and all ages.
Sounds like a lot like what's going on at the UW-Madison Space Place, Jim. And as a matter of fact, Dean will be speaking at the Space Place.
That's right. That's right. I'm very excited to welcome Dean back. He's been a guest speaker at Space Place in Madison before. So next Tuesday night, so we have a guest speaker the second Tuesday of every month. It's a regular thing, open to the public at 7 p.m. second Tuesday. So next week then, on August 8th, Tuesday, August 8th at 7 p.m. at Space Place, Dean will be there in person to give us a talk about one of his recent topics. I'll let him talk more about that if he wants to. But anyway, we look forward to that. And yes, we do an awful lot of public astronomy at UW Space Place, 2300 South Park Street. Find us on the web at spaceplace.org is the easiest of the various websites. So I would encourage everyone to join us there for Dean's talk. We don't have a 170-plus-year-old telescope there, but we do have our old telescope on campus, which we can talk about later at Washburn Observatory, of course.
I definitely want to get to that. But as I understand it, you have dug into Pluto quite a bit. Well, maybe not literally, but...
Not literally, but in my imagination and with a lot of science, too. I recently wrote a book. It's a children's book called How to Teach Grown-Ups About Pluto. So the basic gist of it is it's a little comical look at the nature of science and how we've changed our ideas of what Pluto is based on evidence. And so I guess what I found out was that there's a big generational divide, that the older you are, the more you're in favor of Pluto remaining a planet, and the younger you are, the less you care about that whatsoever. And so we see this generational divide between kids and adults, and I started feeling really bad for the kids because they know so much about space. And so I would give a talk. And, kids would come up and ask questions and tell me about everything they're learning. And then an adult would bust up to the front and say, Pluto should still be a planet. And I thought, that's some rude behavior. And so I needed to make a way for the kids to help their adults through the traumatic loss of a planet. So that's my my book. I hope people enjoy it.
Oh, it sounds great. Well, and we can maybe talk about that a little bit more. But I want to get to the sky. And Jim, maybe you can tell us what's up in the sky right now for fun watching.
Well, there's always great stuff going on in the sky, of course. And so we encourage people to get out. And probably the most headline worthy thing, I suppose, that's going on right now is we have a nice meteor shower coming up, the Perseid meteor shower, which is a pretty reliable yeah. meteor shower every year in the towards the middle of August. The peak's usually right around the 13th of August, and of course, all depends on weather. But given that, we have a good one this year because the moon will not be. Sometimes the full moon or nearly full moon yeah. will spoil a meteor shower. but the moon is going to stay out of the way for us this time, being within a few days of new moon at the peak of the meteor shower. So the thing to do is to look for a dark sky. The Perseid meteors are very reliable. They're related to a comet that orbits the sun once every 133 years or so, but that the debris that the comet leaves around in its orbit is something that the Earth in its orbit intersects every year at the same time on an annual basis. And so we'll see those bits of comet matter burning their way into our atmosphere. That's what we see in the sky, that bright streak of light. Some people will call a shooting star or something like that. We'll see those in the early hours. Well, not necessarily in the early hours, but usually they peak in the early hours after about midnight. Midnight to dawn, on the average, is the best time. So planning to do some stargazing on one of those nights of the 12th or 13th of August, or really a few days beyond that. The peak is not instantaneous, so a few days before or after there's good meteor activity, too. So that's probably the biggest thing to mark on your calendar at the moment.
Yeah, well, Ohio's not that far from Wisconsin, really. If you think about it, you must have the same meteor shower, haven't you, Dean?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the Perseids is one of the better ones for a lot of reasons, and probably for Wisconsinites because it's in the summer compared to the other ones, which are, you know, peaking in the Leonids in November and the Geminids in December. So I don't know about you all, but going out after midnight, 2 a.m. in August is a lot more pleasant than going out in November, December.
Although I think the best one shower I ever saw was the Leonid in November when I happened to be in northern Wisconsin next to the Shawamigan National Forest. So no light.
It is an incredible thing to do. And yeah, being out in the country is a big help. Even if you see just a few, it's a real memorable experience.
Well, I'm going to agree with you.
So the other thing we're going to talk about the current sky is people have been noticing that just a few weeks ago we had Venus very bright over in the western sky right after sunset, and it was kind of a fixture up there since way back in the spring. It's gone now, and which is kind of interesting. It only took a couple of weeks for it to catch up with the sun, so to speak. It's in its orbit, moving in between us and the sun. Last few weeks, it's just sort of dropped out of the sky, so you won't see it in the evening sky at all now. Mars is still there right after sunset, but it's been pretty dim for a long time. It's about at its maximum distance from us, so not very bright. And then you don't have any planets in the evening sky until, I forget just what time, whenever Saturn rises, like 10 p.m. or something along that line. So we do have kind of a planetless, for a little while, evening sky. And we won't have... we'll have a Saturn after it rises, but Jupiter doesn't even rise until after midnight right about now. So fall is going to be great for Saturn and Jupiter. But in the meantime, we've got stars and constellations and of course, Perseid meteors, too, to look at.
So lots of things still to look at. I was thinking about this because for me, I'm a morning sky person, especially in the winter. Well, I'm up at around 5:30 in the morning, but it doesn't get dark. I mean, now I'm not seeing much.
Sure, it's already light.
But one of the joys for me of that early morning jog is in wintertime because it's some great things to see in the winter.
Yeah, if you're up an hour before sunrise right now, you've got several planets over there to choose from.
For sure. Well, the James Webb Telescope might have spotted three dark stars. And, either one of you could answer this. Let's go to Dean. Dean, what are dark stars?
I don't know that term. Maybe Jim knows. I haven't followed that story, but I've, you know, in all my years, I've never heard of anything called a dark star. But, Jim, are you familiar with that one?
Yes, I have seen the term used. It's an entirely hypothetical object at this point, where the energy generation is not like what we would think of as a main sequence star, and they're luminous for a completely different reason, which might have to do with dark matter. I'm not familiar in great detail with those particular observations, but I did see that headline, and so I looked up that term dark star. But as I say, it's entirely theoretical. If that's what they've seen, we won't know it for a while, because there's going to be a whole lot of confirmation that has to be done on the basis of that. But the spectrum of these things is not of a normal star, at least in these first findings. The first thing is somebody else has to show that the first observations were correct. And then it's got to be generalized to find hopefully some other objects like that, so you can actually say you've got a category of these things. And then they can start arguing about just what's going on out there. So that could be exciting down the road. I wouldn't get too excited about it. These kinds of things have happened, you know, before. And then, one thing or another turns out they actually are a main sequence star in some kind of an interstellar cloud that changes the, you know, whatever.
Jim highlights the difference in the astronomy world. So there's called the observational astronomers, and there's the theoretical astronomers. And the two of them have a friendly rivalry between them, because the observational ones like me are like, yeah, show it to me, I got to see the picture first. And the theoretical ones are coming up with some great ideas that may or may not be backed up by evidence. We always have some friendly debates between the two of them. So I guess I just showed which side I'm on. I'm on the observational side.
You have to work together.
Well, exactly. And we do. We're very friendly with each other. We just like to poke fun a little bit at each other, too.
Well, I tell you what, you're all talking about observations here. And I think Bob in Tomahawk has a kind of an observation question for us. Let's go there. Bob, hi.
Hi. I appreciate your show. My family, we don't have a lot of experience looking up at the night sky, but I'd like to get more involved with it. And I'm wondering what you'd recommend for an introductory telescope. Something that's not cheap, but at the same time, is it going to break a budget?
Well,
yeah, that's a really good question. I would say the telescope that I kind of point out to a lot of people are a style called Dobsonians. These look like kind of cannons. They move left, right, up and down. And you can get a pretty big size one, you know, 6 inches or 8 inches in diameter. That's the size of the mirror. And, you know, we're talking maybe $500-$600 nowadays for these. But there's smaller versions too, but I kind of point people towards those. So if you look up a type of telescope called Dobsonian, you can get a bigger aperture for a cheaper price. And, I kind of personally shy away from the computerized ones myself, just because then you got to learn the computer language also. But, I don't know. Jim's got some cool
Jim's
experience
got
with
something,
this.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So you need to think about a couple of things. One is obviously your budget, and then the other big thing is how portable do you want this thing to be? It's easy to buy a telescope that turns out not to be very portable. You don't even want to lug it out of the basement or wherever you keep it. And then consideration might also be, like, if you want kids to be able to use it and things like that, then of course you need it to be simple. But I quite agree with Dean that the best overall solution for beginning astronomers is a Dobsonian telescope, and you can get good ones that range anywhere from $300 and up.
And they can
be computerized too. That's certainly not a big deal. I would beware of the lower end telescopes that are also what they often call go-to telescopes. That is, they move themselves, you know, they're motorized and all that kind of stuff. At the low end, sometimes the mechanical details on those sorts of things are not so great. So yeah, I think a Dobsonian is a good one. I often send people to Orion Optics. Not all Dobsonians are made equal, are created equal, and they have some good options in there in the Dobsonian category. There are plenty of other reputable makers too, but I like Orion's products.
All right, Jim Lattice, director of the UW Madison Space Place, and Dean Regas, who's an astronomer for the Cincinnati Observatory in Cincinnati, Ohio, our guest as we talk about space. Give us a call with your questions. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert's our producer today. Trina LaSusa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking space with Jim Lattice, director of the UW Madison Space Place, and Dean Regas, astronomer for the Cincinnati Observatory in Cincinnati, Ohio. Before we go back to the phones, maybe talk a bit more about the James Webb Telescope and some of the things that have been going on with it.
Right. Well, one of the most interesting things to me, they announced it's just now been a year since the Webb went into full-scale operation, I guess.
Yeah.
And they, as part of that anniversary, the Webb team released a fascinating photo of a star-forming region. It would be, the Webb is an infrared telescope, so it's important to realize it's looking at a different part of the spectrum than, say, the Hubble. And when you look in the infrared, you can actually see through a lot of structures, dust clouds, particularly in our galaxy and other galaxies for that matter, that are normally opaque at ultra, at the optical wavelengths where the Hubble moves works. And it was a fascinating picture of what's going on deep inside a star-forming region where there are these very young stars, protostars, and the process in which they form, where they expel jets of matter out of both ends of the orbital plane, what will be the orbital plane of the planets that are undoubtedly forming deep inside there. And the geometry of what's going on there has never been described so clearly as in these photographs, which are just astoundingly
amazing
clear.
Amazing photos. I've seen some of them.
Yeah, the structure in there that we're seeing is really going to change the way astronomers think about star formation and protostars, and ultimately that means planet formation. And so it comes down to why are we here? What kind of things led, you know, to a planet like Earth and people like us? So now we're literally peering into these places that we couldn't see before without the Webb telescope. It's just been an astounding instrument.
Rona in Cameron has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Rona.
Hi, good morning, I guess it is. Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question. I'm really excited about this program. My daughter graduated from college, and she's going to go into astrophysics.
Cool.
Before she does that, I'd like to go take her to an observatory so we could have a little us time. And I'm wondering if the Cincinnati Observatory has a lot of interactive things, and what would be a great observatory to just go visit for a trip for the two of us?
Oh, absolutely. The observatory in Cincinnati is awesome. It's very interactive because anytime it's a clear day, they let you look through the telescopes, you know, put your eye up to the old telescopes. So they're mostly open on Friday nights with some Saturday nights also. And then we have daytime tours where you can learn the history and even do some solar viewing where we can put solar filters on the telescopes and see them. But it's very interactive because you get to see how the instruments work. You get to move the dome. You get to open and close the shutter. And it's a pretty, it's an amazing spot. So I would say just check out our website, CincinnatiObservatory.org, for all the things that are coming up.
Yeah, I didn't catch where the caller's from.
Cameron. So in
Cameron,
Wisconsin.
Yeah. Well, if I could throw in, Dean's right about that. Of course, the Cincinnati Observatory is a fascinating place. Right here in Wisconsin, we have the Yerkes Observatory, which is near Lake Geneva, on the shore of Geneva Lake in Williams Bay, Wisconsin. And it's also open for tours Now, it has in the last few years been refashioned from an aging research institution into a historical and educational site. And it's one of the birthplaces of modern astrophysics, which happened right there in southern Wisconsin, in part there, in part here in Madison as well, in the 20th century. So a trip to Yerkes Observatory is well worth it as well.
Rona, there you go. Good luck with your trip with your daughter. Appreciate it very much. Let's go to Chris in Fairchild next. Hi, Chris.
Hi. So I observed a meteor, and I'm certain that it landed in close proximity to where I was at. And I was curious if there's maybe a science foundation or somebody that it would be worth reporting it to. What can you do, or what would make good sense for the community to report these things in some fashion?
And Chris, this was just recently?
Yeah, it was, well, about a month ago, I was on my way home from work, and it's about 2 in the morning, and this thing had come across the sky bright enough to light up the sky, light up the road in front of me, and I'm certain it was some form of meteor or, I don't know, maybe space junk or something that had a long green tail behind it, and it was, like I said, low enough to lighten up the road in front of me, so I'm certain it landed in somewhat proximity to where I'm at.
Yeah.
Well, those appearances can be pretty deceptive. Those things are generally much farther away from you than you think. It might very well be that some fragments of it came down, but where that might actually be with relation to where you were when you saw the trail in the sky could be tricky. There is the International Meteor Organization, which if you see a particularly bright meteor, what we often call a fireball, you can report those, and they keep track of them. And you could, for instance, you could go there and you can put in the date and time when you saw that, and probably you weren't the only one. There'll be other reports of it. And then they take those reports and they triangulate, and they can figure out just where that was coming from and whether it might have been orbital debris or solar system debris. There'll also be, if anybody else found fragments of it, you'll find that there as well. But I wouldn't encourage you to go hunting around too long, because you could spend a lot of time trying to turn up fragments, unless you really see them come down.
So again, where would Chris go for that?
International Meteor Organization, but I think the website is, let's see here.
There's another one called American Meteor Society. That's the one, my usual go-to one. So it's fireball.amsmeteors.org. But that's because I check on dates. If somebody reports something like that, you can check to see if it's been reported by somebody else. So that one, yeah, that's the place where I would always go. But yeah, for a meteor streak, when you're seeing that streak of light, that's 40 to 50 miles over your head. So once it enters lower than that, then it kind of disappears. You can't see that bright flash anymore. So it's still flying 40 miles down before it hits the ground. And I don't know why this is, but we get a lot of reports about meteors from people watching from hot tubs. And the story always goes, we were in the hot tub last night, and then I know what's going to happen after that. They're going to talk about the meteor, and they think it might have fallen into their neighbor's yard, but it probably fell 40 miles away.
There you go, Chris. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Do a little research on that. Be worth it. Mike and Slinger, we'll go to you. Hi, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Larry and gentlemen. Just want to give a shout-out to my astronomy club. We meet at the Slinger Community Center first Thursday of the month, and there were some questions about scopes. We do have a loaner scope program in our club.
Oh, cool.
The club is it's free to come in and check us out. A low-cost membership if you plan to stay. We have speakers every month. I was also going to mention that we do have a program with a couple of the local libraries that will lend out scopes. So check out West Bend area, the libraries in that general area. And so we do maintain them and keep them up to date. You can check them out just like you check out a book, and you got questions, come to our meeting, and we have a lot of guys that love to talk. We do have an outreach program. We have an observatory at Harrington Beach State Park. So we have an agreement with the State Park guys. And so we have a 20-inch Staub there.
Wow.
And a nice scope. We do hold public events, viewing, typically during the bright sky nights, so we can see the moon. And that's what usually the youngsters like to see. People like to see the moon, the planets. But we have that will be on our website, Northern Cross Science Foundation, NCSF.com. And come on out. We also have a small 5-inch that we do some picture taking, some astrophotography. So,
good.
You guys should come out to the space place on the 8th and so we can meet the club. We can have the clubs merge or at least hang out. We'd be always glad to talk to folks. If you come on out to the space place on the 8th, that would be great.
Yeah, that sounds right. NCSF.com, a place to go.
Yeah. And of course, amateur astronomers are very welcome at Space Place. We have a really good relationship with our local club, Madison Astronomical Society. We often collaborate with them as well. No doubt we'll see some of them at Dean's talk as well. But yeah, if you want to come down from Slinger, we'd be happy to see you at Space Place.
Absolutely. Thanks, Mike, for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. We heard some,
I just wanted to go back. I finally found the website for the International Media Organization, which is actually very easy. It's imo.net.
imo.net.
And on their homepage, there's a menu called Observations, and you click on that, and you'll see Fireball Program, and that's where you can start. You'll start to dig into that information that we were talking about earlier. So, I don't know why that was so hard to find, but I just wanted to mention that. And then Dean mentioned the other one, which I'm not familiar about, but I suppose you can just Google for American Meteor Society, was it?
Correct. Yes. Actually, I just did a Google for report fireballs, and that's what came up.
Oh, okay.
Okay, well, I want to mention Northern Lights.
Yeah.
We heard reports of, quite a few reports, actually, of visible Northern Lights. Where could they have been seen?
You mean how recent?
It's been just a little. It hasn't been that long back.
Yeah, right. Not that long back. No, there was a couple of months ago. There was a really good display just here in Madison, which I think I slept through. But it was a we're at a good time. There's a lot about that in the press these days, and that's specifically because of the level of solar activity that we're at right now. The sun is passing into its phase of maximum activity during the solar, what's called the cycle, the solar activity cycle, every 11 years or so. And so we're going to see the possibilities of auroras for the next year or two, something like that, as the sun stays active. The thing is that they're very hard to predict. They see an outburst on the sun. There are various kinds of these solar flares and things that then can produce auroral activity on the Earth if all the little pins line up in just the right way. So you see lots of, we might have aurora borealis in 2 or 3 days, but everything's got, all the dominoes have to fall just right, and more times than not, they don't. So we tend to see these little spurts of publicity that lead people to say, I heard there's going to be an aurora tonight. Well, what you properly heard was that there's a small possibility that if everything actually works out, might be, and they might, it might be more over Siberia than over Wisconsin. So there are some good sources, though, to watch for that and not just depend on the casual reports that you'll find on the web. And the one I like to point people to is called spaceweather.com. And they report on solar activity, and you can find on their reputable information about the chances of auroral activity. If you really want to dig into the nuts and bolts of it, they lead you off in a couple of directions
And Dean just gave you a thumbs up for that.
Oh yeah. That's my go-to website also, spaceweather.com. And they have places where you can see where the aurora is basically on the globe. And of course, the farther north, the better for the northern lights. We had a chance to see them in April when we had that big solar storm, but we were clouded out here, so we didn't get to see them. But there were reports as far south as Arkansas and even northern Arizona got to see northern lights in April. So I'm crossing my fingers that we get another blast off of the sun that triggers these, because they are unbelievable. They are one of the most amazing sights to see. So, Jim and Larry, I hope you can dial up some northern lights for my trip up to Madison
when you're in
next
Wisconsin.
Week.
So we'll do what we can.
A caller couldn't stay with us, but was a little skeptical and wondering what's the importance. I mean, what's the value of astronomy and watching the stars? And I mean, what value does it have to us as a society? And well, I'm sure you both have comments. Dean, let's start with you.
Well, I'll go from a personal perspective. I think that there's something about stargazing that is just so peaceful and amazing and inspiring, and really opens up your mind to things. And I think it's one of the things that really kind of struck me was kind of since COVID, we were all quarantined, we're all trapped inside and not sure what was happening. And there was, for me, a great sense of solace going out and doing stargazing, where you could get out under a dark sky and just watch everything. It's a time that you can kind of just, turn off all the other things and just look up there. Even if you don't know what you're identifying and what you're seeing up there, just to take a little break. So that's from a personal level what it does for me. And I highly encourage folks to try this on their own, because there's so much up there in the sky that you can actually see. Even if you're in a city, you can still see a lot. And just being aware of what's going on up there, I think for me, that's – so I'm answering from a personal perspective. I think there's definitely lots of ways to look at it too.
Yeah, Jim?
Well, yeah, it has – I mean, I think Dean addressed it really well from a personal – standpoint. Being aware of your environment is a really important thing. But also, if we think from another angle, that is in terms of the value of astronomical research. Like you could say, why is it so interesting that we got these pictures from the James Webb Space Telescope? I would say that the history of astronomy has been the driving force in the development of modern science. There have been plenty of cases whereby studying the rest of the universe, we ultimately find things that it turns out we need to understand right down here, from the behavior of the sun to the elements that make up the universe and make up us, and understanding our own origins as well. For all the reasons that we do any sort of science, astronomy is really important and has led the way in a number of important developments in the understanding of the universe. So I think it's very important, of course.
And Jim, just to go along with this, you've got a book that'll be coming out probably maybe next year. It's called Chasing the Stars: How the Astronomers of Observatory Hill Transformed Our Understanding of the Universe, which kind of goes along with that a little bit. But tell about that book.
Sure, yeah. So that's I have been fascinated for years. I'm not originally from Wisconsin, and in fact, the study of Wisconsin astronomy was not my original emphasis in the history of astronomy. But I've sort of found myself swimming in it, treading water a little bit, and then ultimately, it begins to make sense. The history of astronomy at the University of Wisconsin, and more broadly in Wisconsin, like Yerkes, but the Washburn Observatory was a seat of the early development of astrophysics. And yet it's an observatory that, like the Cincinnati Observatory, dates from well before anybody thought about astrophysics, thought about astronomy in entirely different ways. And it was fascinating to me how very important things like understanding of the nature of our galaxy had their roots right up there on Observatory Hill at Washburn Observatory. And so
about a half mile from where we're sitting.
Yeah, right, just right over there, which, by the way, is open to the public on a regular basis Wednesday in the summer, every Wednesday night. Weather permitting, you can go up there and for free and look through that beautiful 19th century telescope that we have up there. Yeah, so I found myself telling that story over and over again, and it sort of turned into a book. And so that's coming out from the Wisconsin Historical Society Press in the near future.
Yeah, and we'll get you back to talk about it when...
Happy to, of course.
And, of course, I want to mention again before we run out of time that Dean's going to be speaking at Space Place next week.
Next Tuesday at 8 p.m. at 7 p.m. at UW Space Place.
And Dean, tell us again, what are you going to talk about? I mean, you mentioned your book, and I imagine your talk may involve Pluto a bit.
Yes, that is the topic for the day, is Pluto and the new discoveries on Pluto and its past of a planethood and non-planethood. And so I understand that I'm going to be walking into a lion's den of all sorts of questions, because I know there's a fair amount of people that are very passionate that Pluto should still be a planet. So that's, you know, one of the things with my the book about how to teach grownups about Pluto is that I walk myself through this, because I thought you can't get rid of Pluto. Come on. This is. And then I kind of came around, and I go through the arguments of this. And and Larry, I don't know if you've ever seen a kid's book with the five stages of grief illustrated, but that is in my book to hopefully walk the grownups along from anger and denial all the way to acceptance eventually. I know it's a hard road, but I hope you can join me and come out for a little bit of fun and a little look at Pluto on the 8th.
Dean, thanks. And thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It's been a real pleasure. I hope we have a chance to talk again. And Jim, always a pleasure to have you with us, of course.
Glad to be here. Thanks, Larry.
Oh, man. Jim Lattice, director of the UW-Madison Space Place, faculty associate in astronomy at UW-Madison, and Dean Regas, astronomer for the Cincinnati Observatory in Cincinnati, Ohio. Two great places to visit, for sure. Well, how's the heat been affecting you? It's actually kind of nice out today, and it was yesterday, but we had a week of heat that was not good, as far as I was concerned. Our weather guys will talk about heat and cold and all kinds of things weather-related, and that's next on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.